You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
While Americans debate a $15 an hour minimum wage, there are fast food workers in Denmark earning $20 an hour. And that's just the tip of the Nordic iceberg. The Scandinavian countries have larger social safety nets and higher taxes, and yet they have job markets as strong as or stronger than ours, and more people expressing satisfaction with their work and their lives. How do they manage it? Could we follow their example? This past August, sociologist and activist George Lakey joined us to talk about his book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and We Can Too. It's published by Melville House. I began by asking him whether Viking economies exist outside of Scandinavian countries like Germany and Holland.
It's most fully realized up there in the Nordic area, and therefore economists call it the Nordic model. But there are certainly things in common that are held by some other countries, but especially, and I call it Viking economics because I especially thought it would be interesting to trace the cultural background. So Iceland and Norway and Sweden and Denmark all have Viking ancestors. I thought that would be fun.
But not Finland.
No, Finland actually ethnically comes from the Magyar people, who are related actually to the Hungarians as well. So on the other hand, when economists talk about the Nordic model, they do include Finland.
Because it shares similarities
much.
To the,
right.
their neighbors?
Very much, very similar.
By yeah. what – which majors, measures are they doing better than the United States?
Well, for one thing, they don't let the market go out of control. They think that the market is a useful – and flexible instrument as long as it's supervised in such a way as to keep benefiting the common good. So when
government regulation is not an issue in these countries?
Oh, no. It's totally assumed that people count on it, in fact, because they know that a market run awry means disaster for people in general.
What about things like homelessness or poverty or crime?
They think poverty is so 19th century. Like, why would a modern industrial economy put up with poverty? There's just no reason for it. So what they did was rolled up their sleeves and pretty much abolished poverty, not through just one measure, but through multiplicity of measures.
Even when new immigrants are coming into the country?
That is a challenge, and it's especially a challenge been taken on by Sweden more than the others, although Norway to some degree as well. And so you will see, for example, I just checked the unemployment figures again today, the latest ones, and you will see that Sweden has more of a struggle absorbing the immigration. In fact, they absorbed more Syrians than any other country per capita during this latest flood of immigration from the Middle East. And so what we can expect is an economy that struggles for a bit. They had to close their doors because they were overwhelmed. But they're willing to do that struggling. The majority of Swedes say, no, hospitality is important. We have to accept this.
But we are talking about homogeneous societies.
Not anymore. That's certainly historically the case. But now, 1 in 7 Norwegians is from out of Norway. That's true in Sweden as well. Not as many people from out of Denmark. But nevertheless, there's been quite a change. It used to be just all these blue-eyed blondes when I first went to Norway when I was a young man. And now, I'm walking down the street and I hear people walking behind me, chattering away in fluent Norwegian. And I turn around expecting to see blonde and blue-eyed, and there they are in dark skin with people from Africa and all kinds of places.
Is it a coincidence that the state whose people probably have the closest ties to Scandinavia, Minnesota, remain in many ways more progressive than their neighbors in the Midwest?
That's particularly striking in North Dakota, which had a tremendous Norwegian concentration. They actually created a state bank, the State Bank of North Dakota, which then protected the North Dakotans from the kind of problem that most of the rest of us had in the United States after 2008. The state of North Dakota has distinguished itself for its stability, and they also have treated their oil extraction in the same way as Norway has. So I would say the strongest influence has been felt in North Dakota.
But not everything is rosy. Doesn't Iceland have one of the highest rates of alcoholism in the world?
Alcoholism is definitely a problem in the northern climes. It's very depressing. I can tell you, having lived through a winter in Norway, when you're losing the sun, all the people who are affected by seasonally affected disorder are really hurting, and they tend to turn to alcohol. So, and you'll find it, though. You'll even find a difference between southern Norway and northern Norway. Beyond the Arctic Circle, people in the summertime, they are giddy and laughing and partying all the time. But in the winter, it's a pretty morose kind of place. So, but it's a problem in that way in Russia, in all the northern climes.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine in Alaska as well.
Yes, that's my I'm told that.
The U.S. says higher per capita GDP. Isn't GDP the standard gauge for comparing economic performance internationally?
It's a gross one. I'm glad it's called gross because because it doesn't take into account the distribution internally so that you can have a very high GNP and also high poverty at the same time. The Nordic approach is to go for equality, income equality. And so in the various international ratings that are published, they score the highest for equality. So those are very prosperous countries, but they share their prosperity rather than let it be gobbled up by their economic elite.
In the aftermath of the financial crisis, the Great Recession, and the failure of mainstream economists to anticipate either, are social scientists considering new measures to evaluate economic health?
The most radical one and controversial one is the happiness index.
But that's in Asia.
Well, no.
Isn't that in
an Asian country. That's right, Nepal. It scores very, very high on that. And the DAC does very well on that. But the Nordics do very well on that as well. It's of course, a composite index. The nature of an index, it's a composite of factors. But and it, as I say, remains a bit controversial, but it's fun to think of people, even though they do have the challenge of their spot near the Arctic Circle, that they end up being reported by outsiders, by these folks who compile the index, as the happiest people.
Yeah. My guest is George Lakey, L-A-K-E-Y. His book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Globalization, offshoring, outsourcing, deindustrialization have been blamed for stagnant wages in the United States. What effect have they had in Scandinavian countries?
Those countries have always been living in a globalized world. Actually, we need to stop to think about it, because they're small countries and they've been dependent on the sale of raw materials, especially Sweden, Norway, and Iceland. For Iceland, what is the global market in fish? You know, that's going to determine how they do. In Norway, the global market on fish, but also on logging, because logging has been a major product.
What about oil, which has...
Now oil. That's
but,
right.
But oil has been in decline. Has that affected the Norwegian economy?
No, because they are diverse enough. And actually, oil is I think often exaggerated by Americans in giving credit to the prosperity over there, because Sweden and Iceland and Denmark don't have oil, and Denmark has a little bit, but they're all doing very well compared with the U.S. But Norway does have a particular abundance and had to figure out how are we going to deal with this abundance in such a way that it doesn't run away with inflation.
How do they compare with Germany, which is the top performer in Europe?
Top performer in some ways, but not with regard to what I call the indicators of well-being. That is, indicators like health, indicators like ability to for young people to steer their own course in life. It's striking to me that, for example, Norwegians have more individual freedom than Americans do, and more individual freedom than Germans do in the way in the choices that they can make. The society has been set up in the Nordic countries in such a way as to maximize the freedom of choice for young people and middle-aged people. Let's say middle-aged people get tired of their careers and wish that they could strike out on their own as an entrepreneur. Well, Norway has per capita more entrepreneurs than the United States does. They generate more startups than the U.S. does, because they really support their entrepreneurs. They support people getting out of dead-end jobs or jobs that they perceive to be dead-end and doing something different.
On the other hand, as I understand it, they if you go to art school in most of these countries, you will get support for a while. You can get
That's right.
studio and all of that. And yet we aren't seeing too many great artists coming out of these countries.
Well, they're very tiny populations, of course. And they do have that historic difficulty of being so homogenous because actually creativity is on the side of diversity. This is something that I think is now pretty broadly accepted, that diversity promotes innovation. It's actually been one of the glories of the United States. I love that about our country, that it has such a history of diversity. And then we've been enormously creative, jazz and all the things that we've contributed to the world stage. And that's because of our diversity. Well, the Nordics are late catching up on diversity. And so, on the other hand, the Swedes outdo the United States on patents. So there are areas of creativity and innovation where they still set a very high standard.
Have you seen debate or anger over politics and the economy of the kinds of things we see here, especially during this election?
They have done so. That is, they had enormous polarization a century ago. Because a century ago, it was basically the majority versus the economic elite. And so the polarization became very great. And in the 20s and 30s in a country like Norway, you had a span going from the communists on the left, the hardline communists on the left, to the Nazis on the right. There was a Nazi party. And there were Nazis in Sweden as well. So they had a tremendous, actually a broader kind of polarity than we did. And when
during World War II, and Denmark and Norway were in the Nazi German orbit.
That's right. That's right. They were occupied, and the homegrown Nazis were very pleased about that. So that they've gone through tremendous polarization. Now they're very unpolarized. Now their political spectrum, it has enormous agreement, a kind of consensus politics. And the reason for that is because they went through this massive change. The polarization brings, you know, the opportunity for change. They went through tremendous conflict. The majority of people ganged up against the economic elite, which had been leading the country historically, and basically fired the management. They basically said to the 1%, you're just not doing well. You could do way better, but you're not willing to, and therefore we're taking over and we're creating democracy here.
On the other hand, after many of the elections in the North, newspapers in America are filled with stories about how we're seeing a change. The leftist government has been voted out of power. Conservatives have come in. There's a whole new wave of political thinking in
right.
Scandinavia.
I'm so glad you raised that question, because this is a problem of how our journalism gets a bit skewed by our own environment. So I was sitting, for example, I've interviewed widely different people, and that included the head of the leading conservative think tank in Scandinavia, a Norwegian conservative party member. And I was talking with her about a range of things, and she said, you know, I just back from Washington. And it got me thinking again about your President Obama. And I'm just so impressed with him. And I really think that he would fit very well in the Conservative Party in Norway, because our spectrum is such that we conservatives are really about where your leftish Democrats are. And then our spectrum moves left from there. And so I would love for your president to join the Conservative Party. So when American journalists notice that the parties that call themselves left over there lose their majority and the parliament is taken by the so-called right wing, their so-called right wing is actually what we would call left Democrats.
My guest is George Lakey, author of a number of different books and articles. The most recent, the one we are discussing, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It is published by Melville House, and we will continue our conversation after this.
We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with sociologist and activist George Lakey this August about his book from Melville House called Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and We Can Too. Before the break, Professor Lakey was explaining that in Scandinavian countries, the so-called right wing is actually more like what Americans would consider to be left-wing Democrats.
Is there a Nordic model for an economy, ways of doing things that we could follow in this country for better results? First of all these countries have parliamentary governments, so that means that there's probably less of the kind of partisan divide that we have here.
Well, that wasn't the case before they had this mass movement that the different countries had that forced a major change. That is, back in the day, they did have parliament, and they did have parties that bitterly disagreed with each other and fought tooth and nail, and stalemates happened. And then it was the economic elite that would decide what they would do anyway. And so they would. It was a kind of. Sometimes people say when I give talks about this, well, that's a little bit like here where we have an apparent Congress and debate and so on, but it ends up that the economic elite are deciding what we do anyway. And so they had a similar situation, I think, a century ago, and that's why it was so important for them to dig in at a grassroots level and build a movement that could make a power shift. But the and in that regard, I think Parliament isn't different from Congress. On the other hand, in the detailed way it is, because parliaments do support coalition among multiple parties, and that's not what we have. We have the two-party system, and that. On the other hand, for the people who feel that they are not represented by the two-party system, then they feel very out in the cold, whereas in the parliamentary system, of course, they can have a party representing them.
Well, there's the other part of the parliamentary system. The leader of the government is a member of the majority party. In the United States right now, we have a situation where the president is Congress is dominated by the opposition party. So that leads to all sorts of conflicts.
That's right. And stalemate, right? Kind of.
If you don't like it in a parliamentary situation, you vote out the party in power and you just have another party in power.
So it is easier to go to the polls, back to the polls, and get the election called again in the parliamentary system. That's an advantage.
The economist John Roemer and others have argued that we need to develop social ethos, a path leading to a society where people value solidarity and community more. Do Scandinavians already share something of that social ethos?
Yes, they do. And I think they experience it more fully than we do. And I think that has to do with their historical homogeneity. That is, because we have been so riven by the system of slavery and how long that endured, and then the legacy that still divides us, we have a harder time for white people, for example, to feel a real sense of empathy and solidarity with people of color. And so that is a problem. And one of the things that I'm excited about today's current as compared with earlier years is I think more white people are taking responsibility for our side of that. I'm white myself, are taking more responsibility for that and saying, hey, it's about time we move past this and remedy it. The problem, of course, is that we can't really get past it unless we address the economic situation as well. And that's one reason why my book is published now, because it's so current both to our racial justice challenge as well as to our economic justice challenge.
None of the Scandinavian countries use the euro as their currency, unless you count Finland. Have they benefited from staying out of the eurozone? Noted in the British Brexit campaign?
Yes, it was really characteristic. I mean, they split down the middle on the EU joining, actually. Iceland and Norway stayed out of the EU. Sweden and Denmark joined the EU. But when Sweden and Denmark joined the EU, they held out for their own currency and they won.
Similar to what Britain had
they
done.
Won. That's right.
But are they resisting the EU in the same way that the British did? Feel that the EU sometimes lays down too many rules that they're uncomfortable with?
Exactly. So there is internal tension within Sweden and Denmark about the fact that they're members. But on the other hand, they're members, and that's not going to change. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. What was really surprising was that Norway refused to join the EU, and they refused because they felt that the bureaucracy and the lack of democracy would get in their way. And your earlier question about the currency, it has definitely paid off for Sweden and Denmark to have their own currency because it gives them wiggle room. And so when the austerity decision was came down from on high in the EU that we're going to punish countries for the failures of their bankers, that the Swedes and Danes both could hold out for the retention of their own monetary system.
Which, of course, didn't happen with Greece.
No. Greece was a sitting duck.
Social scientists talk about Nordic models in economics, foreign policy, education, welfare. Are you looking at one of those Nordic models or all of them? How similar are they?
I'm interested in all of them. The book is pretty holistic in that way. But I think one of the most striking things and hard things for Americans to picture is that with regard to welfare, the Nordic countries had, before their big shift that happened in the 40s and 50s, they had tried welfare as a way of handling poverty, and they found that it didn't work. That is, means testing, trying to develop specific programs that would be targeted toward poor people, they found weren't effective. And so they actually shifted. So in a way, it's a misnomer to call them welfare states because what they gave up was welfare in the American sense, and instead they've substituted universal services. So what that looks like in the United States is Social Security. Social Security is a universal service. Everybody gets Social Security no matter what their income was when they had working lives. The same with Medicare. And those universal systems, in fact, those are Nordic design principles that we've already adopted in our country and have been working pretty well. And one reason why the universal programs work so much better than the anti-poverty programs is that everybody has a stake. So, for example, when on the far right of our country there's been an effort to do away with Social Security or to hand it over to Wall Street, which in effect I think would be giving it away, there's been fierce resistance across the board. Middle-class people as well as working-class people have resisted that.
And including a lot of conservative Republicans.
Exactly. Because it is a universal system. Whereas it's very easy to cut food stamps or to cut any program that's designed for the poor because it doesn't have as broad political appeal. So the Nordics actually were able to abolish poverty partly because they gave up welfare. Welfare, I'm saying it in the American sense of welfare. They gave that up and substituted for it universal services. So everyone goes to university for free. Everyone goes to college for free. Everyone goes to trade school for free. Everyone gets into apprenticeship programs for free. And everyone gets health care for free.
But not everyone is competent as everyone else. And I'd imagine some people do well in a job and others don't do well in a job. What happens if you're one of those people who just can't hold your own? Doesn't that often lead to poverty?
It's such a great question. I asked that very question at a research institute in Oslo. I said, what about that? And they said that their attitude is that work is a fundamental way in which people participate in a society. And therefore, everybody who is at all able to work and they're within working age, should really be given all-out assistance to do that. And they told me about a kind of story that goes the rounds in Oslo between a social worker on the one hand and a labor office person on the other, in which the social worker is saying, look, there's nothing we can do with Ola. He's a drunk. He's been a drunk for 20 years, and he goes on these binges, and there's no way we can get him a job. And the labor person will say, you mean he's drunk all the time? And the social worker says, well, no, he's not. He goes on this binge for the weekend, and then it takes Monday, to sober up, and by Tuesday, but then he goes on another binge on Friday, and that's it for him. So he's obviously not a candidate for the the workforce. And the labor person says, well, then go find him a job. In fact, I will find him a job that will employ him on Wednesday and Thursday morning. And because we must put Ulla to work, because Ulla deserves the chance to participate in his society and not be a drifter. That's the kind of conversation that goes on. Very strong work imperative. And for that reason, more people are in the labor force in Norway than in the United States, where
There's no unemployment?
Oh, there is unemployment, but it's very, very low. And the reason for that, in fact, they have to, at the moment, they have 50,000 guest workers from Poland to fill in holes because they are generating so many jobs, and they take meticulous attention at supporting people to find. Now, of course, some people say, I can't work because they're a round peg in a square hole, right? But if you've got the assistance of people saying, let's keep trying until you find the square hole that will, or the round hole that will work for you, then there's way better chance that you will actually be able to hold a job.
George Lakey is my guest. His book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It's published by Melville House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. All of this is paid for by very high tax rates. And there are people in this country who claim that we pay the most taxes in the world, although I think I read some statistic that indicates that we're actually 47th highest in the world. But people don't mind paying those taxes. In the end, you work really hard. You should be able to keep the money you earn.
Except that then you wouldn't get the benefits that you get. You know, my dad used to tell me when I was a boy and learning to be a consumer, George, you get what you pay for. Meaning, don't just pick up something shoddy because it seems cheap, because we do get the value of what we pay for. Well, that is their attitude toward taxes. So, if, in fact, Inc. magazine sent a journalist over to Norway to interview the highest paying tax people, entrepreneurs, millionaires, and so on, and asked them, how do you feel about these incredible taxes that you pay? 50% is an average, and they will also, and Norway also taxes wealth at the rate of usually 1% of people's wealth. So in addition to paying income taxes, if they're wealthy, they're also paying a wealth tax. And so this journalist said, well, how do you feel about paying these high taxes? And that was the answer. He got my dad's answer over and over. People said, well, hey, we get what we pay for. We get stability. We get a phenomenal country to live in. We get all kinds of free things. Like, I don't have to worry about whether my kid is going to go to university. I don't have to put money aside for that. I don't have to worry about my dad getting a terrible cancer and having to mortgage the house for that. We get so much for our taxes. We're happy to pay high taxes.
But a common view is that higher taxes are a disincentive to innovation. Higher government spending crowds out private investment.
It's just not true. Empirically, it's simply not true. There's, as I said, there's more startups over there than there are here. Innovation at a very high rate. In fact, worker productivity is higher there than here. So this is actually a very big philosophical difference that goes with the Nordic model. It was Gunnar Myrdal who won a Nobel Economics Prize for this theory, an alternative to the classical economic theory, which is you have to have punishment hanging over people's head in order to get them to work. And he said it's just the opposite. It's human nature to want to work. By the way, Sigmund Freud made the same observation. It's human nature that has us working. The question is, do we get to do meaningful work, and are we justly compensated for the work that we do? And people will be happy to work. And the results are statistically very clear, higher productivity there than here, despite the fact that we have a sword hanging over us.
On the other hand, the United States is a major driver, arguably the major driver of the world economy. And New York City alone has a larger economy than the combined economies of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, even though they have two times as many people as New York City. So we're talking, are we comparing apples and oranges here?
In a way, because you're not taking into account of the resource base. One of the miracles that I get into in the book of the Nordic achievement is how far they came with relatively fewer resources than the U.S. The U.S. not only has an amazing abundance, and historically it's phenomenal abundance in our country, but also has derived tremendous benefit from Latin America and other countries that we've been able to control and extract from. So the U.S. becomes then a center of accumulation, which enables it. And I'm not denying the productivity that's been here, and certainly not the innovation that's been here, which, as I say, is supported by our diversity. Nevertheless, when you take the resource base into account, and also the fact that we've had an enormous internal market, which economists believe is a tremendous help to the economic development, and the Nordic countries have had tiny markets. And I mean, Iceland's 320,000 people. So what is it, the size of Buffalo? So when you have the advantages that the U.S. has, then it should be a world driver. And when you have the disadvantages of the Nordic model, it excites my curiosity all the more to know, well, how is it that they are able to accomplish what they accomplish?
If differences in outlook, attitude, or philosophy account for a lot of the Scandinavian difference, what could Americans do to adopt some features of the Scandinavian system and still accept it as American?
Well, we already have adopted some. For example, we used to have in New York City a free university, right? And the U.S. has had a fling with free higher education, and it's tragic, actually, that we gave that up. There's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't have that.
It was paid for by taxes.
Yes, of course, because there's enormous economic benefit. In fact, you'll enjoy the story of the first – when I enrolled in the University of Oslo in Norway, and I paid my $14 matriculation fee, and then I checked – twice, you know, I thought, well, surely there's more money you're wanting from me. And they said, no, this is it. And I turned to some Norwegian friends I was making at the time, other students, and I said, how does it make any sense that university is free? I don't come from a country where that's true. And they said, look, George, wouldn't you say that brain power is an economic resource for a country? I said, yes, of course. Well, he said, then why would you want to short circuit the economic resource of the country by making a contingent on parental income? You don't want to fully develop the economic resource called brain power, and that's what we do, and that's why it works so well here. And I thought, whoa, talk about pragmatic. Those people are so sensible. So that's one of the specific things. We made a start with free universities in some places. We can return to that, pick up where we left off, and advance it far more than we have.
Can any of us go now to Oslo or Stockholm and go and enter a university?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You're welcome to go.
But I'd have to learn how to speak the language.
Well, it's not that hard to learn. I'm not much of a linguist, but I did learn Norwegian.
George Lakey, his book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. It's published by Melville House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for your great questions. Enjoyed it.